workforce, inclusion, environmental justice, and more. Taking place at the Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. More information at sewingroom.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Street violence. After a peaceful protest in Nepal turns deadly, one of the young demonstrators tells us what propelled him and so many of his peers into the streets. He's still in shock at how quickly the protest shifted and at seeing so many young people wounded after being shot by police.
And she is not thumping her chest about thumping its chest. A Kentucky woman doesn't believe she's a hero for saving a life through CPR, but the drunk baby raccoon she saved might disagree. Or it might already have forgotten, I guess.
I guess, yeah. Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on People Powered KAXE. And coming up at 7 o'clock, Deborah Ann is your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Patchy fog tonight, partly cloudy, lows 49 to 56, and mostly cloudy tomorrow with that patchy fog early on, then becoming sunny, highs 72 to 75. Support for KAXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. It is time to hear from our album of the week, Arrivals and Departures, Adventures of Captain Kurt. It's by Curtis Harding. This is the fourth album from this Atlanta, Georgia-based soul singer. It's a sci-fi concept album that brings classic soul to a space opera. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening from Curtis Harding is called The Power.
Joy comes faster. Rain don't feel like it used to. The sunlight feels better. Well, just live your life and don't you give up now. There'll be strife, but we gon' dance it out. We'll show you love, light gon' grow.
From our album of the week, that is Curtis Harding. The song's called The Power. Let us know what you think. Text 218-326-1234.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
terminally offline, tens of thousands of young people in Nepal push back hard when the government threatens to ban social media. But our guest says what they're really fighting for is fundamental change.
Out of bounds, Israel's surprise attack on Hamas officials in Qatar surprises and outrages world leaders and terrifies a journalist who was sheltering with his family a few hundred meters away.
Desperate times, desperate measures. With more unhoused people living in encampments in Barrie, Ontario, the mayor declares a state of emergency and explains why he thinks that is the right call.
Homecoming on hold. Some people from Annapolis County, Nova Scotia, were given the green light to return home today after weeks of uncertainty caused by wildfires. But one woman tells us the decision isn't that simple.
The Caine Mutiny. He was in Jaws, The Revenge. He's also won two Oscars. Michael Caine is unpredictable, as he's just proven yet again by refusing to stay retired at 92.
And she really restarted something. A Kentucky woman tells us about giving emergency CPR to a patient she discovered in a dumpster, a dangerously drunk baby raccoon. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's so glad she seized a wasted opportunity. In Nepal, the prospect of a social media ban has led to an explosion of anger on the streets. Yesterday, protesters set fire to government offices and officials' homes, and police shot 19 people dead. Today, the prime minister resigned, but the chaos continued and troops were deployed to attempt to restore order. The largely Gen Z protesters say their concerns go far beyond online access. They say they're fed up with persistent government corruption and economic inequality. Prasida is a 22-year-old student who demonstrated yesterday. We reached him in Kathmandu, and we've agreed to withhold his full name because he fears for his safety.
Prasida, what is your reaction to the Prime Minister's resignation? Does it feel like a victory to you?
For me, I think the resignation is a victory, but it's not like the end of everything. Resignation for me feels like winning a battle, but we haven't won the war against corruption.
As I understand it, you know, you were out at the protests yesterday, huge protests. Things began peacefully from what we've been reading and hearing. Then you saw up close how things shifted and you saw that people were getting shot. Just take me through how things changed. What did you see?
So at first, people were marching up to the parliament building. So it was very lively. We're having fun. We're looking at people. Everyone's young. And then once we reach near the parliament building, we're like just hanging out, seeing what's going to happen. And eventually, you know, people started like trying to get into the buildings and stuff. And then eventually we start hearing these popping sounds. And then we kept hearing them for like 30 or 40 minutes. And then we start seeing like a lot of ambulances going back and forth.
It wasn't until you saw the ambulances that you realized it wasn't just sound or you know, rubber bullets or something, that this was live ammunition that was being fired.
Yeah, and like then we started seeing bikes go here and there carrying people. And then we started seeing people carrying people. And then we just started seeing just random people standing with like bullet wounds. And then we were like, okay, this is too serious. We gotta go.
That's not a small thing to see person after person suffering from those kinds of injuries. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm better. But if I like, I don't know, if I'm like too alone by myself, I start like feeling kind of weird. I get very like anxious. A random bullet could have hit me or my friend, and I would have turned out very differently. So, you know, it gets me it makes me feel very weird.
How did you and your friends get away and try to get to safety?
After getting like tear gas two times, we saw a can, like a tear gas can, land pretty close to us. So we, you know, started like going to like a section of that road where it's like not directly exposed to the other side where the cop, where the police was. But we saw a person get dragged out with a bullet wound from there. So we were not sure if someone was shooting from there. So we didn't want to risk going there. So we started heading back. And then that's when we saw more people with bullet wounds. And then we also saw like an army truck parked with people, like with, you know, military people in there. So I don't know, we just started like rushing down that road, and then we found a shortcut and headed straight back to my home.
Did you expect anything like this when you set out to join that protest? You know, the tear gas, the bullets, any of it?
No, definitely not. I thought it was really just going to be, I don't know, like a very peaceful, very fun protest. Like I just thought, you know, it would be a fun protest with, you know, a bunch of creative people singing songs or whatever. Yeah. And yeah, it just went so south so quickly. I don't know.
The government has said, you know, government offices, the homes of officials were set on fire by some groups of protesters. Do you feel that the response that you saw can be justified in any way?
Nah, definitely not justifiable at all, because they were fully armored and they were like shielded up. They had, like, they were not going to be hurt in any way.
As our listeners heard, what sparked all of this, or what seems to have sparked all of this, was the government's plan to ban most social media platforms. Was that what this was about for you?
It wasn't entirely just that. The social media ban was like, you know, the last thing that kind of motivated everyone to join the protest, I believe. But it was more about corruption and speaking up against, you know, how the system was designed against us. The government wanted these big social media apps to register with them so that they had control over our data, so that they could see who was posting what and to regulate how many accounts we could make. And I feel like that's against freedom of speech, and that's, you know, that prevents us from speaking against the government. And while that was happening, there was a trend that started on social media exposing these Nepo babies. And after a few days of that, they actually went ahead and banned the social media apps.
The Associated Press is reporting that because unemployment is so high and the economic issues, thousands of young people leave the country for other places daily to find work that they can't get in Nepal. What is your future like? What do you see for your future?
Honestly, yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I would love to stay here, but there are very, very less opportunities here. I would love to go outside and like pursue a master's degree outside and come back and do something for my country. But if things don't seem to improve, going outside would be the best solution for me.
Are there political leaders that you and the other Gen Z protesters you were with that you see and think could be a better political future for your country? Are there leaders out there that you're looking to and trust at this point?
Right now, there's a few names that we want to like kind of guide us, but not, we're not sure if we want them to be leading us. There's a few, but yeah, not particularly that we completely trust.
Prasidha, I very much appreciate this. I'm glad you're doing okay, but I do hope you find people to talk to in those times where you're feeling alone and strange about what you've experienced. Please take care of yourself, okay?
Yep, thank you.
We reached 22-year-old student Prasidha in Kathmandu, Nepal. We agreed to withhold his full name because he fears for his safety. There are more and more homeless encampments in Barrie, Ontario, and the mayor says that constitutes a state of emergency. Alex Nuttall made the announcement at a news briefing today, saying it would help the municipality, quote, reclaim its streets, unquote, in the face of what he says is a growing crime problem. The move includes directives to create a task force to coordinate the response to illegal drug use and to expand access to social services around the city, among other things. We reached Mayor Alex Nuttall in Barrie.
Mayor, encampments are not a new reality in Barrie. In fact, we've spoken about the situation with you on this program before, just back in December. What has happened now that has pushed you to declare a state of emergency?
Well, I think that what we've seen is in the encampments over the last number of months, more violence, certainly more drug use, and a larger effect on the community around them. Double homicide occurred this summer that was in one of our encampments. There was an environmental disaster in that area, emergency in that area that was declared by the province. And the city had to undertake a testing of all of the water in the area that resulted in E. coli with five times the closure limit. So we're doing everything we can to try to make sure we are both providing services for folks that want help and want out of that way of life, but also maintaining a standard of what it means to be a citizen here in the city of Barrie and to be respectful of our neighbors.
Have any of those encampments and some of the issues you've talked about, have any of them been shut down since those incidents?
Yeah, we closed two encampments through an environmental emergency order, but some of the issues that were perhaps hiding in forests or wooded areas became far more prevalent and transparent and visible to the community at large. Just last Wednesday, we had a tent that, was just on the side of the street in front of our courthouse, was raided by the police, two crossbows, a starter pistol, drug money, drugs. Clearly somebody had set up shop there and was enforcing their territory inside of this encampment.
The last time you were on our show, as I mentioned, was December. At that time, Ontario Premier Doug Ford announced new proposed legislation to help municipalities deal with encampments. There were going to be, the police were going to be able to levy heavy fines, and there was potential prison time for repeated drug use and things of that sort. That was supposed to help. That was controversial at that time, but that was supposed to help. Why has it not helped?
First of all, I think on the funding side, we've received a lot of funding, but those dollars are in the process of being delivered in the sense that the County Simcoe was the one that's responsible for delivering social services in our area. There's many parts of it that are not yet up and running. The shelter funding we've received is going to start having an impact when we receive the new shelter beds in November, but those just haven't landed yet. And so the funding side, I actually don't think there's a big requirement for a whole lot more funding. And the second piece is mandatory rehabilitation, because I think it's a more direct line for it.
And that's been controversial as well as a suggestion.
And that is definitely controversial. You're right. I was walking in downtown Barrie on Saturday night. Somebody was having an overdose, and the ambulance came in, and we didn't ask the individual if we were allowed to. There was no communication as to whether the intervention should take place for that naloxone, but it was delivered. And then the individual walked off and went into the night. We have no idea what help or support was needed, or if they again overdosed that night again. What we need is the opportunity to provide that individual help and support.
You want to offer that help, but the fact that there are so many encampments suggests that that help doesn't exist, or there's not enough of it. There's not enough places for people to live and get the help they need. So why are you sure that this will do it?
Is there enough spaces? Probably not. Is there enough a variety of help in the sense that, there's shelter space, there's transitional housing, there's affordable housing, and then there's market housing, and so on and so forth. At the same time, what capacity exists is being rejected by those that don't want the help. One of the major moves we made in the city of Barrie with our partner organization, the County Simcoe, was to engage with our local health center, our hospital, the RVH, so that there was a health care approach to this rather than any other approach, and making sure that the mental health concerns and addictions issues were at the forefront.
We've spoken to people in the past who live in encampments in cities right across Canada, and I hear you with the cases you're talking about, the very serious and extreme cases you listed that pushed you to declare a state of emergency. But there are often people who are struggling, can't afford housing. They're not any of the things that you've listed, but they're concerned about moving. They don't want to lose their belongings. They don't feel safe in shelter spaces. It's not that they don't want a different place to live. It's just what's there is not safe for them. Yeah. That's how they're feeling. So as you consider the dismantling of these encampments and the timelines for those, how can you ensure that those will be peaceful, that people will be placed safely in other places?
We've gone out. The county has been able to secure already some of these places and some of these beds, not in a shelter environment, to be able to help in those types of circumstances as well. But we can get them help as soon as possible to get out of that situation.
And Mayor, what is the timeline you're thinking? Are you planning to dismantle all of the encampments? What kind of timeline?
Yeah, our plan is to get down to zero in terms of tents in the city, but that's going to take some time.
How many people?
We have about 20 encampments, and it changes day by day because some of them are one or two tents, but we still classify them as encampments, and some of them are 50 and 60 and 70 tents.
Mayor, I appreciate this. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Anytime, and thanks so much for having me.
Alex Nuttall is the mayor of Barrie, Ontario. That's where we reached him. Misty Combs wasn't thinking about becoming a hero when she stepped in to save a life in a Whitesburg, Kentucky parking lot. She was thinking about the baby raccoon. Ms. Combs is a nurse who works at her local county health department. In a video of the rescue, she can be heard yelling, "Come on, baby, come on!" as she delivers life-saving CPR to the seemingly drunk and definitely drowned animal. We reached Misty Combs in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Misty, for a lot of people living in cities, it's not unusual to encounter a raccoon or maybe even a raccoon in distress. But a raccoon in distress that appears to be drunk is rare, I think it's fair to say. How did you first encounter this?
I came into work that day, and some people had been saying that they'd seen a raccoon wandering around the parking lot, which was a little bit weird because usually we don't see them a lot during the day.
Yeah.
And a couple of my coworkers went back outside just to see what was going on, because we do deal a lot with animals and rabies here at the health department, which is where I work at.
Right.
So we went back outside and we were like, "Hey, what's going on with this raccoon?" The closer we got to the building that joins our parking lot, which is a moonshine distillery, we heard noises. It was like little chitter chatters coming from the dumpster.
Oh.
And it was two baby raccoons in the dumpster.
Oh no. They crawled in there?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And
first of all, let me just say, anyone who's heard that chatter and is aware of raccoons, even if they don't wish them harm, might just keep on walking. But you approached and then you went further. Take us through what you did.
Yeah. So there was a shovel there, and I went ahead and got the first baby raccoon onto the shovel and sort of like tossed it out gently to its mother, and it ran over and it joined its mom.
Oh.
And I knew that it was her babies because, like, earlier in the season, like, we had seen them together.
Right. And were you worried, though, that the mother raccoon might be upset that you were intervening?
No, I honestly think that she wanted us to help.
So that's the first baby.
I'm no raccoon whisperer, okay? So I don't know.
You're front of the line for winning that honor at this point. I'm the raccoon yeller. I just yell at them. Yeah, maybe I need to.
But I seen her and I was like, I think she wants us to help. So I sort of tossed her first baby with a shovel, and then the second one, it was underwater. And
like in the dumpster.
The dumpster.
Oh, no.
So my friend that was with me, who was also my coworker, she sort of scooted it over to me with the shovel, and I leaned over into that dumpster, and I grabbed the raccoon by the tail.
With your bare hands. You were not wearing gloves.
Right. I did not have time to go in and get gloves and PPE and all that. I just grabbed it and pulled it out. It was not responsive. It was not breathing. It was soaking wet, and it was full of water.
And did you smell alcohol on it, or was the other one behaving in a way that you thought they might have consumed some alcohol?
No, the other one actually was just fine.
Okay.
But now this one smelled awful. It smelled like it had drunk all night and was...
Stayed out past curfew and... Yeah.
Oh, yes. Man. It was at the bar or something. Yeah. This one smelled awful.
But you still helped it. So then, so you realize it's not responsive. Your nurse instincts kick in, clearly. Defying every other instinct that I certainly would have had. So what did you do?
I started doing chest compressions on it, but it was little bitty. So, and I was trying to keep my distance because I was afraid that it was going to come to and eat me up.
Oh, my God.
So I was doing chest compressions on it. And the more I was doing compressions on it, the more it was throwing up water. So it started coming to, which was a miracle, I thought, because we all thought it was dead. And so Fish and Wildlife had to come and get it, and they ended up taking it to the vet. The vet said it was drunk like we thought, and they gave it some fluids, and Fish and Wildlife, it did end up waking up that evening, finally.
Yeah.
And Fish and Wildlife brought it back to me the next day, and
it was
good as new and all fluffy. And I guess he may have had a small hangover. Hopefully he learned his lesson.
Well, let's hope.
And I got the honors of turning him loose.
Oh, and how did that feel?
It felt great, yes. I felt like I had accomplished something.
Well, I think you probably do on the daily as a nurse, but I hear you about this. It's quite a special thing you did. But as you know, not everyone loves a raccoon. And in case I haven't made that clear, I'm might be one of those people. They are considered pests and a nuisance in many other places. But how are they seen in Whitesburg?
I think there is a lot of people that feel the same way. And at that time, it wasn't up to me to decide if he should live or die. Well, I guess it was. Okay, I'll take that back. I just took my instincts, and I decided, hey, I'm going to save him, and I'm not going to choose if he dies today, okay? I'm going to do the best I can and try to help him live.
Would you do it again? Sounds like you would.
Yes, I would do it again. I don't know if I would let people film me.
A little bit too much attention, maybe?
Yeah, I'm just not used to it all, but it's okay. Maybe I inspired somebody else to save an animal.
Thank you for this, Misty.
Thank you so much.
Misty Combs is a nurse in Letcher County, Kentucky. We reached her in Whitesburg. We often refer to great artists as inimitable. Well, I'm not saying this actor isn't brilliant, but he's very imitable.
You can take whatever you want from this ship. But these people have come a long way. And all they want right now is to get the hell out of here alive.
Oh, bloody hell.
Get us started double time.
The breath on that thing.
You are alive.
Oh, let's get out of here, Alan Brody.
The honeybee is vital to the environment. Every year in America, they pollinate $6 billion worth of crops. If you kill the bee, you're going to kill the crop. If you kill the plants, you'll kill the people. No!
Michael Caine in three of his worst movies, Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, Jaws the Revenge, and The Swarm. Now, Mr. Caine himself has said these were not his best work. In fact, he's appeared in a lot of pretty bad movies, especially in the 1970s and 80s. But as he famously said about Jaws the Revenge, I've never seen the film, but by all accounts, it was terrible. However, I have seen the house that it built, and it is terrific. Now, as I mentioned, everyone does an impression of Michael Caine, including Michael Caine himself.
Yours is the most impersonated voice in the business, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, everyone. Everybody does. I can do it.
Can you do it?
Yeah, yeah. Hello, my name is Michael Caine.
And nowadays, Michael Caine is doing a very specific impression of Michael Caine. He's doing 70s and 80s Michael Caine in his 90s. He's 92, in fact, and he has announced his retirement now several times, most recently in 2023 when he told The Guardian he was doing just one more movie. Except that now he's coming out of retirement to do a project he simply could not turn down. Was it a chance to work with one of the great directors or a gifted co-star? An opportunity to explore a complex character? What project was so remarkable that he's coming back? Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's The Last Witch Hunter 2, and his co-star is Vin Diesel. Now, none of us have seen the first one, but I guess they missed some witches the first time around because the witch hunter is back. So is Mr. Caine for some reason. I'm going to assume a terrific house reason. You know what? More power to him. He's a working actor and a hard-working actor, and that's not just my impression. Here's Blunt Chunks with Natural Actors.
I can pick up any heartbeat whenever I want it. How about an alcoholic garden with the old winds of summer just departing? I can make a movie with all of my friends, 'cause they're natural actors. They got serious minds and they look great on camera. My mind will be appreciated. I keep drinking coffee even though I said I'd quit. I guess I'm just a caffeine addict. I should take care of myself, but I gotta have fun too. Today I had
Blunt Chunks with Natural Actors.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll get a close-up view of Israel's attack on Qatar from a journalist who was close enough to feel the blasts.
And to mark the release of Dan Brown's sixth Robert Langdon novel, we'll revisit an interview with a charity shop manager in the UK who was begging people to please stop donating the Da Vinci Code. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 7 o'clock, Deborah Ann, your volunteer host for On the River, great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, it's more great music on Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support comes from Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders available and more at drinkdragonfly.com. And we thank the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com. Watermark Art Center's Poetry Slam season kickoff is Thursday, September 18th at Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. Music starts at 6 o'clock, performances at 7. Pre-register by contacting the Watermark. We continue with As It Happens.
When Hamas officials sat down to meet today in Doha, they were expecting to talk about a peace deal. But it was clear from what happened next that the war with Israel was still very much ongoing. In a move that's been condemned by the UN, Gulf States Prime Minister Mark Carney, and leaders around the world, Israel launched an airstrike on the building in Qatar where that meeting was taking place. 6 people were killed, though Hamas says its top leaders survived the attack. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it was both a response to the Hamas shootings in Jerusalem yesterday and an attempt to take out Hamas officials Israel claims were behind the October 7th attacks. Andrew Mills is a Reuters reporter in Doha. That's where we reached him.
Andrew, you live very close to the building that was hit. What was it like from where you sat when this strike happened?
I was at home, working from my home office today. My kids had just gotten home from school early, so they were kind of hanging out, and I was in the office when really we heard a series of maybe 6 or 7 very loud explosions. I watched the windows kind of buckle and thought they were actually going to blast through. Unfortunately, I've been in these situations before, and windows are something I'm always concerned about. So I gathered the kids downstairs and the bathroom where we would be protected from any glass. Luckily, we didn't have any broken glass in our house, but these attacks were, you know, 500 meters from here.
How old are your children?
13, 11, and 8.
And how are they doing?
They're okay now. Mm-hmm. They're okay now. It was pretty terrifying at the time, but my wife and I sat down and kind of had a long talk with a journalist in the Middle East in their house. They know a lot of the context of what's going on, and so we feel it's like important to keep them up to speed so that they have good information.
Of course. And as a journalist, and you've been through these sorts of things before, you've said similar things, at least in those moments, clearly safety and safety of your family were of the utmost importance. You acted on that. And then, I mean, after that, once you know everyone is safe, do you then start information gathering? How did that unfold for you?
Yeah. Information gathering on on the floor in the bathroom through my phone. So, yes, of course, started talking to contacts in the government and other sources I have, and diplomats here, and trying to figure out what was going on. I was pretty sure I knew the location of the attack. Mm-hmm. This is a, you know, this is a residential compound that, you know, I've been asking what is going on there, because it had been, certainly since the beginning of the Gaza conflict, has been kind of fortified and guarded by Qatari police and cameras everywhere. And so clearly there was something going on in that compound. But there are other compounds throughout the city where we know that Hamas has their political headquarters and, you know, political offices, rather. And so but it's something I, you know, it was so close to home that I was pretty sure that's what that was.
Yeah. What have you been able to learn since the strike about who was in that room, in that compound, in that building that was hit?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know all of the people who were there. Mm-hmm. Hamas has said that 5 of its members were killed. They say that the political leadership of the organization were not killed in the attack. So we don't know if they were there or not, but Hamas is saying that they weren't killed. We also know that some, I think, one of the Qatari security personnel was also killed in the attack.
And in terms of why this attack would happen now, you know, we can get to what Benjamin Netanyahu is saying and Qatar's response. But from where you sit, why did this happen now?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to exactly why now, but the Israelis certainly have said that they were targeting Hamas leadership and that they were targeting top Hamas negotiator Khalil Hayya, who has been kind of leading the diplomacy, as it were, for Hamas. I had reported last night that Qatar's prime minister had met with the Hamas leadership in an effort to press them to accept the latest U.S. ceasefire and hostage release proposal. This Hamas negotiating team has been continuing to actively negotiate with the Qataris up until, you know, 24 hours ago or so.
Qatar has been trying to serve as a peace broker, offer some sort of neutral ground in the ongoing talks or on and off talks between Israel and Hamas. What is your sense of what this is going to do to Qatar's efforts to try to negotiate a peace?
We're waiting to hear from the Qataris to see if this is going to alter their role in any way. I suspect that there are some serious discussions going on right now among the leadership in Qatar as to how their role might change if they continue to try to be a mediator in this conflict. You know, Qatar has a long history of mediating between Israel and Hamas, as they do with, you know, all sorts of adversaries around the world. And throughout this whole conflict, we've had Israeli negotiators here in Doha meeting with the Qatari leadership. And then, you know, the next day, the Qatari leadership shuttles over and speaks to the Hamas negotiators. And this has gone on, you know, countless times over this, throughout this conflict, since maybe the second or third day after October the 7th. So Qatar has been at the forefront of this. And, you know, whether an attack on their sovereign soil is enough to convince them to decide they don't want to do that anymore is a major question mark right now.
Benjamin Netanyahu has said, in his view, that this could, quote, open the door, unquote, to the conclusion of this conflict. Others feel differently, saying this is a major escalation. Is there discussion there where you are? Are there concerns of a strike in response or some sort of military action?
Look, as I've learned over the last 2 years of this conflict, you think that there's a threshold that's not going to be crossed, and then it gets crossed. And that has happened time and time again, really very blatantly here in my neighborhood in the last couple hours. So I wouldn't ever venture to predict what's going to happen next. But it's certainly a dangerous moment for the region and something that we're all kind of waiting to see what happens next.
Andrew, I'm glad you're safe, and I very much appreciate this. Please take care, and thank you.
Thanks very much.
Andrew Mills is a Reuters reporter in Doha. That's where we reached him. Members of the Muslim community in Newmarket, Ontario, are still shaken after a hate-motivated incident last week. Investigators with York Regional Police have charged a 54-year-old man who allegedly planned to blow up a local mosque and the home of a Muslim family who'd been his neighbors for more than a decade. The National Council of Canadian Muslims has been in touch with the family, who are choosing to stay anonymous. But in a statement, the father of the targeted family says they are still living in fear. Stephen Zhao is a spokesperson for the National Council of Canadian Muslims. He spoke to the CBC today.
I talked to the family yesterday in Newmarket. This is a neighbor who's been at the home of the targeted family, before to look at their heating ventilation issues, because this person that's being accused has HVAC expertise. And the idea, according to the police, was that he was going to use this expertise to tamper with gas lines in order to do damage, perhaps an explosion to the local mosque and to this neighbor Muslim family that he's known for over 10 years. So he's been to this target's house to look at their system. So he knows. And their kids have seen each other. They know each other. And when the police approached this family, telling them that they were the planned targets, it's a fact that they're not yet, they've not yet come to terms with as of right now.
Why do you think this continues to persist? Like I said, it hasn't been the first press conference. It's not the first conversation I know you've had. It's certainly not the first conversation I've had. Why do you think it still persists, even though we keep raising awareness?
Well, take this in this case, in Newmarket, according to the police, the person suspected and charged has been consuming over a period of time online content of a nature that's just is anti-Muslim, Islamophobic, however you want to put it, far right. And I don't think we've really, as a country, really began to be able to address in any substantive way how this problem proliferates online, how people are kind of ideologically influenced by narratives that depict Muslims as the main problem in their lives,
right,
as the main systemic issue or problem or bad guy that Canada can't overcome, or kind of a scapegoat situation. So until we actually begin to have some laws that strike the right balance or knock down barriers and increase trust between Muslims and others who maybe don't know much about their Muslim neighbors, don't know much about Islam, before we can have a broad conversation or solutions around that, the problem probably won't go away.
Stephen Zhao is a spokesperson for the National Council of Canadian Muslims. He was talking to guest host Angie Seth on Metro Morning. It's been over 2 weeks now since hundreds of people across Annapolis County in Nova Scotia were told to leave their homes. The Long Lake wildfire has been burning out of control since August 13th. But today, provincial officials announced that the fire had been declared held, which prompted an announcement that some evacuees could finally head home. But some of them say the decision to return isn't that simple. Luann Eisner lives in Annapolis County. We reached her in Middleton, Nova Scotia.
Luann, how are you feeling after a couple of weeks out of your home? The fire's not under control yet, but things have improved slightly.
Well, initially we were very excited about being able to go home and check on our place. And then when some more information was coming out, we realized that we were on a one-hour alert, which meant that we could be evacuated again within an hour of our, and we would have to be out. And also we have like our two dogs, so we were worried if we weren't home when the evacuation came in that we might not be able to get home in time to get them before the road closed. So that was a big concern for us.
And where have you and your wife been staying all this time?
We've been staying with family in their garage, and we're very grateful for that, actually. So we've been making out quite well, and I have a camera surveillance, so I was able to check on home like whenever I wanted, so that was reassuring to us as well.
What have you seen? How, what kind of shape is your house in? Because you've been able to go back in the past as well, just briefly?
Yes. Just this past weekend, we were back, and so everything looks great. It was relief just to see that, and so everything looks good. There's, you know, I mean, something smells smoky, and of course, it's still smoky at times there. My wife and I both have we have a cough from being there, just from the smoke. Mm-hmm. So it all depends on the way the wind is blowing, how smoky it is too.
You seem pretty calm. Are you worried about this, you know, whether you will have a home to go back to if things continue in this way, if they aren't able to continue to hold it?
Well, I'm less worried than I was, mainly because I think that now that it's being held and it's been, it hasn't grown in several days now, that is reassuring. Although I do know that it is burning deep under the ground. Mm-hmm. So I'm worried about flare-ups from that.
You've had friends, neighbors who've been able to go back and check in on their places. What are they telling you?
All of our friends have said that their place is still intact and mm-hmm. everything is good, and we're all feeling very grateful for that. It's very overwhelming mm-hmm. to put into words how grateful we are for all the people that are volunteering. Like, it's hundreds and hundreds of people every single day volunteering to fight this fire. And it makes me proud to be Nova Scotian and Canadian.
That day that you had to leave, how much time did you have? What did you do?
Well, we had warnings prior to, which we were grateful for. So we had our vehicles already packed. So basically all we had to do is put our animals in the vehicle and the food and a few other things that we grabbed and we left. So it was a surreal feeling leaving. Before we left, we said goodbye to our house just in case. And then we went down to the lake and we said goodbye to the lake because we didn't know, what was going to be left when we came back. We didn't know if there would be any trees, if it was going to be all black. Like, we just had no idea.
In the middle of all of this, you're still working. You drive a school bus for children in the region.
Yes,
you were driving
I do.
Them today, right?
Yes, I was, right.
How are they dealing with all of this? What do you say to them?
Well, some of my students are back home. Some are not back home mm-hmm. because it's still uncertain. I would say they're very grateful to be, or they're very happy to be back to school and back in their homes. Mm-hmm. So it's, we've talked about it a bit on the bus. And also some of my kids are wearing masks now because it is so smoky at times. So, yeah, it's it was good to see them all and to touch base with them and know that they're all okay and everything.
Do you have any sense, Luann, when you and your wife might be able to go home and stay home?
No, we're not sure when the fire will actually be under mm-hmm. control. And we try to stay positive and it's just really hard not knowing, how long this is going to last. And it seems like it's been forever already. So, we just don't know what the future is going to hold yet. And but I do know that they're battling this fire with everything that they have. And,
Well, Luann, I hope you get answers and that you get to go home soon. I know this isn't easy to talk about. I very much appreciate your time. Please take care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Luann Eisner lives in Annapolis County. We reached her in Middleton, Nova Scotia. He cracked the Da Vinci Code, found the lost symbol, and confronted his angels and demons. But over 25 years later, Robert Langdon still hasn't given up his page-turning, wildly implausible quest to unlock the thrilling and totally untrue secrets of Christianity. And as befits a new Dan Brown novel, Mr. Langdon's latest adventure, The Secret of Secrets, is being released today not with a few posters and some cardboard cutouts, but with a full-on theatrical trailer.
This September, Robert Langdon returns. A romantic rendezvous in Prague turns deadly. And now Langdon must unlock a shocking secret. As sinister forces surround him, Langdon deciphers ancient symbols to reveal an unthinkable truth that changes everything we believe.
I mean, that's just relatable. I hate when romantic rendezvous in Prague turn deadly. Now, obviously, Dan Brown and his publishers are hoping to have another blockbuster on their hands, copies of which will soon find their way into countless garage sale stacks, free little libraries, and of course, charity shops. In fact, a few years ago, a certain Oxfam bookshop had to issue a plea to the public to please stop donating copies of The Da Vinci Code. Here's former As It Happens host Carol Off speaking to the bookstore's manager, Phil Broadhurst, in Swansea, Wales.
So we've got this massive pile of Da Vinci Code books, and we've put a sign on it that says, you could give us another copy of The Da Vinci Code, but what we'd really like is your vinyl, because that's what we would make more money for Oxfam with, and that's what it's all about.
Well, now, how many copies of The Da Vinci Code does your store have?
Right now, we've probably got about 100 in this pile, but if we kept every one that we got, we'd have a lot more.
Well, how often do you have customers who come in and say, have you got that book by Dan Brown called Da Vinci yeah. Code? How often does that happen?
Well, what happens, actually, is that they look for it on the shelf in the fiction, and it's quite often not there, because we've just put them all into this big pile that's been building. And so they'll go, oh, have you not got a copy of The Da Vinci Code? And we're like, and then we point out the pile, and they're like, oh, you've got lots of copies of The Da Vinci Code.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe you're getting them think that you don't
well,
have
we
any.
We do try to make sure there's always at least one. You know, it's a bit like the rooks at the Tower of London, where they say if the rooks fly away, then the Tower of London will collapse. It's like if we don't have a Da Vinci Code or a 50 Shades, then the walls of the bookshop will collapse.
Because they're made of 50 Shades of Grey and Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, you could have actually built the walls with them, yeah.
Okay, so you said in your note and in this picture that you're looking for vinyl. So is that what sells?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, most of our sales, well, we are a book and music shop, and most of the sales are from books. Most of the money we make is from books. But vinyl is what we get people coming in asking for mostly. The parents used to give us their vinyl because their kids and grandkids didn't want it, but now their kids and grandkids want it. So that's one of the problems, is that it's not getting given to us because the trendy young things are saying, no, Grandad, don't give that Beatles record away, I want it.
From our archives, that was our former host, Carol Off, talking with the manager of the Oxfam Bookshop in Swansea, Wales in 2017.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.